Thank you all for attending my session. My name is Des Traynor, and I'll be speaking about infographics and data visualization. So, where these will cross swords with you guys as either interface designers or web developers is typically in data-driven screens in applications that you're working on. Infographics are also used in domains like journalism, where they want to create a high-impact story, but for the most part, we're going to focus on the realm of software and how you can visualize data inside an application to make it more impactful. So that's me. I can do that pose if you like. I'm at Des Traynor on Twitter. I'm a user experience designer at a Dublin-based startup called Contrast. We design interfaces and we also build our own software, which we charge per month for. My company, Contrast, we're at contrast.ie, and our sort of main offering at the moment is a web-based exception tracker, which handles online errors in apps written in .NET, Rails, PHP, Python, etc. But what we're going to talk about today is loosely this guideline here. So we're going to cover a few different topics around the design and delivery of data visualization inside web applications. I'm going to talk you through how you get to know the audience, i.e. who are we actually designing this for, what the domain is, what are the right words to use, what different types of data you'll capture, how you can visualize them, how you can style them, and then I'll have some closing remarks. And there should be time for questions, too, if you have them. So, a background on visualizations. What's happening in the visualizations world, I believe, is that with the advent of the latest round of high-end design devices such as phones and some of the more fancier web apps, at sort of executive level, people are asking questions like, why am I stuck looking at a grid full of data when the Stocks app on my phone looks great in comparison? And what's happening is they're turning around to design companies and sort of saying, rather than showing me 45 rows by 11 columns full of data, can you give me something more useful, something that I can digest quicker without actually having to do that thing where you hold a ruler against the screen and try to line up rows of data? Because, it's 2011, maybe that time has gone. So the difficulty is it's hard to make these visuals, it's hard to make them better than text. You often see people trying to visualize things like you have $11 in your bank account. There's only one visual for that, 11, and it doesn't make pretty reading no matter how many three-dimensional bar charts you put behind it, beating text is pretty tricky. It shouldn't be too surprising, there's a reason why we've kept with text for quite a long time and we moved away from iconography, if you want to go back through time. It's hard to make visuals adaptable, and that's going to be relevant specifically in the software world because, you're probably used to seeing some of the fancy high-end designer infographics where they're using unicorns to show Obama's approval rating and the unicorns are crawling across a rainbow and it all looks really beautiful. But the problem is you can't automate the display of the hooves of a unicorn or whatever. We need to make these things adaptable so that given a data set, it will visualize it. And that kind of rules out an awful lot of the very, very fancy stuff that you see done in magazines. It's hard to make them useful. And by useful, I mean it's hard to make them, you can make something that looks really, really impressive and you kind of stare at it and you're like, wow, there's a lot going on here, but you still haven't really a clue what's going on. And it's kind of the Google wave of infographics, if you like, right? It's hard to make them readable. So if at a glance the key point isn't jumping off the screen at you, you've kind of failed. This is the whole you have $11 thing all over again. But it's hard to make it so that at a glance, somebody with the right amount of domain knowledge can look at it and understand exactly what's going on. And lastly, it's hard to make them meaningful. It's hard to make them resonate with people so that they can actually, do something about it. The whole idea of these things is that you're supposed to present data and then inform somebody in what their next step should be. So sales are down because advertising is down. Next step, let's increase advertising. So it's hard to sort of tie in that next step to an infographic. One point that I'm going to be driving home with you here is the founder and president of 37 Signals, I'm not sure if many of you know him, Jason Fried. He had a great point. It was more about design in general, but it stands out particular in infographics, is that you must always be clear first and clever second. And if you can't be both, then drop clever, but clarity is what's important here. And that's the theme that I'll be coming back to again. So visuals can confuse. A badly taught out visual, like a badly taught out interface, or a badly taught out drop-down, or a badly taught out piece of code, it'll confuse. Here's a typical example. This is a pie chart that adds up to 183% or something. And yet it's split three ways if you look, to actually look at this, the slicing of the pie. And like this happens. Now, if you think that had to go, like, I mean, I know it's Fox, but I mean, it still had to get out there. A lot of people had to see it, right? Like, you know. Another example, like, this isn't so wrong in a sort of stupidity sense, but it's just, can anyone look at that and really take much out of it? You sort of get an idea that what they're trying to point out is that debt goes up when you're with the red team and debt goes down when you're with the blue team. But if you look at the amount of, like, redundant data there and the amount of junk that's on the screen to make that point, it's not quite clear what the message is. Here's a great one from CNBC. This is to visualize the tragic oil spill a while ago. They were trying to visualize 184 million gallons. So you can see what the logic was. They're like, well, a milk carton is a gallon, so let's get 184 million milk cartons. And then they're like, oh, that's not going to fit. Let's just fade out subtly towards the end. another, this is from the same article. This is what I think is great. This was another way of visualizing the spill is if you take the Dallas Cowboys Stadium and put a can of beer in it. And that was, you know, you're kind of left with the sort of dot, dot, dot. So then they realized no one would understand that. So they put a page of text after it to try and explain what's going on. So this goes, you know, if the Gulf of Mexico, the seventh largest body, which has approximately 660 quadrillion zeros, that's 660 with 15 zeros, you know, it goes on and on and on. And you sort of, when you get through all this, like, and then the last point is the best, because, oh, by the way, as the oil is dispersed, it's substantially greater than what we're showing. So if you manage to perceive all that, the last line tells you, and that's not even accurate. So that's kind of like visualizations, they don't come easy. And what's happened now is there's a movement called the anti-infographic movement, which basically says you can have sexy visuals, no problem, or you can have data, but we're not going to harm any data in the producing of visuals. So they sell these posters that you can put up on your wall to sort of satisfy that need for attractive design, without, like, necessarily, you know, you taking it into your day-to-day work. So how do you avoid this? Like, it's all well and good to laugh, but, like, we need to make sure that we're not the ones who are, you know, being slagged at Nix 12. So it's important that you have to know who's looking at your article. So, I mean, you could argue that maybe the average reader of the CNBC visualization knew what a milk jug was, but that was never the problem. The problem was they didn't really know what 186 million was in context, right? So you have to know who are you designing this screen for, who are you designing this graphic for, and when you know that, then you can work out, well, what do they know? What are they used to seeing? What terms do they think of? What words do they use? And then you can incorporate that into the design. So the question is, like, who is the info for? And obviously, like, me being a user experience designer, like, everyone always says, oh, yeah, Des, you know, the crying heart for the poor users of our software. But it is true that, like, if you're going to design one of these screens, you need to be really confident that you know who's going to receive it. And for a dashboard or a visualization or an infographic, the recipient, there's two key parts to the recipient that matter. And those of you who are user experience designers will be familiar with what I'm going through here loosely under the sort of label of personas. But one thing you need to know is what role is the person looking at this? What context are they bringing to it? So if they're a CEO, like, say, Jeff Bezos here, Jeff Bezos thinks year to year. You could tell him that there's a bug last week on the Kindle store that's affecting IE6. If you told him that, he'd fire you on the spot. Not because not because it's a fireable offense, because he doesn't care. You know, he has to think at a level above that. His main concern is, like, what's Kindle 5 going to look like? How are we going to deal with the dissolution of books? So he's thinking in terms of where is Amazon going to be in 2020, 2015, those sort of terms. Showing him, like, real-time stats for, like, you know, books today, it's beyond, like, he is above that level of data. He wants the high-level overview, but he just needs to know, like, that the sales side is up. You know, somebody else's job is, like, making sure that we're continuing to grow and all that sort of stuff. Another level is an analyst role. And this is, you know, this is where your job is to find trends and correlations in data. This is where you need to actually see what's happening to any given system. So in this sense, you are concerned with time periods, you're concerned with comparisons, you're concerned with projections, those sort of things. And a third role that's quite common is an operations or logistics role. This is often the guy who's in charge of making sure that the whole system is running smoothly. So, you know, are our sites online? Are we hitting our targets? Those sort of questions. If we have problems, what is our estimated time to completion? What's our end user response time? These sort of questions are what these guys would stress about. And this manifests itself in a dashboard in the sense that they need to know, are things okay? That's their first and foremost concern. They're less concerned with things like, 4 weeks ago we had an outage. Today's problem is what he's going to get fired for if he doesn't fix it. So that's one half of a user. What way are they thinking when they approach a large set of data? Say if it is an Excel spreadsheet, say it's a web app dumping out a load of cells. But the question is, what level are they thinking at? And then a second part is, what domain do they work within? So this, you can loosely think of this as what department. If they're sales, then the language that they're concerned with is things like, you know, leads, conversions, what's the average value of a sale, what's the average number of items in the sale, what's our customer loyalty. That's the sort of stuff that they're concerned with. So if you're a sales guy, you're probably concerned with what's today's sales target. If you're a sales manager, you're probably concerned with, is our team performing this month better than last month, because I chewed them out last month when they missed their targets and I want to see an increase. You know, that's the sort of questions you'd have. Marketing is going to be concerned with impressions, loyalty, awareness, market share, how are our competitors doing. And from a marketing point of view, you know, your concern is at a management level, it's going to be, are we gaining or are we losing? At a low level, it's going to be like, is this AdWords campaign working or not? Network and IT is possibly going to concern themselves, depending on the nature of the business, obviously. Things like issues, tickets, lead time, open cases, uptime, that's their concerns. And then, so when you look at these two things together, and this is how I encourage you to sort of think about a data-driven screen when you want to provide a load of data to somebody. Think of the role, think of the area, and then you can sort of work out exactly what information is pressing for them. Like, what can we put up on the screen and what can we visualize that'll answer their key questions on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis? So when we have that, we need to look at the forms of the data that we're talking about. So the best way to sort of find out what are the key pressing questions, because, you know, you can't just force these things on people. You know, they will actually have specific requests themselves. You know, one useful thing I find is if you're in an organization and you're trying to do this, hang around by the printer and see what people are printing out. That's always a good indication of what stuff that needs to get known. If you see someone running towards the boss with like a load of reports, get a look at those reports. That's the stuff that matters. Back to that whole what gets measured gets done thing. But if you're in sales, which of these numbers matter? Is it just today's sales? And depending on some person's role, that is, like, how am I doing right now? Is it like this period versus last period? Is it this period versus our competitors? Or is it percentage change? Is it the average value of a customer? And then this will change within an organization, as in sometimes they're going to be looking at shifting units, and then later on they'll be looking at, well, let's increase the actual money we make per unit. Or, you know, for Amazon it was about, let's see if we can get people to buy books. And then once they achieve that, they're like, well, let's see if we can get people to buy more books when they're with us. And that's where you saw the evolution of these sort of, you know, people who also bought blah bought this as well. And that was with the idea of, like, you know, we're doing pretty well on the customer count, but we want to work with the average books per order count. And then another argument will be, like, let's see if we can increase the price of a book. So that's what they're doing with Kindle at the moment, and it's not going over well. They've started to release, you know, these useless audio supplements to a book or little video clips, and then they charge an extra $10 for it and call that value. The goal behind that is, let's see if we can get more money out of people. So when you know what it is you need to show, and there's a reason why I started there and not with the visuals, is because you can have the best visualizations of the world, but if it's the wrong data, it's useless, right? So you need to tackle what you're going to visualize first before you get into these questions of how can we best display this information. So, and this is kind of to paraphrase Bill Buxton from a couple of years ago, you can get the right data, but you have to get the data right as well. So he said about design, but it's the same point. I've been designing these screens for maybe 2 years now, and what happened was we kind of had one client that we delivered a lot of value for by visualizing a lot of their data, which, you know, they had a popular product, and they released the next edition and sales went up. And then since then, my company's kind of become known as, you know, a great place to go for dashboard design or this sort of stuff. And I'm almost bored with the topic because things tend to fall back into the same sort of categories. I'm sort of solving the same designs over and over again. What's changing is like the branding or the domain. So 1 week it might be books, the next week it might be like laptops, the last week it might be phones. But like the answers are always the same. So just the six key things that I find you'll need to communicate on a dash. There are a few other ones, but like these six will kind of answer most of your questions. One of them, and this is the obvious, this is the you have $11, good luck buddy sort of case. This is communicating a single figure. So this is when you literally have to spit out one piece of information. It's useful in live or for real-time systems when you need to make a very clear point where the precision is required and the real-time is required. The other thing you should know about this is that they often have a tolerance. Like a number, even though it's just one number, it can still have a state. It can be in the red. It can be above normal. It can be, you know, a negative bank balance. And you need to capture that as part of it because that's important. And again, that's, you know, we'll touch on how you visualize like the difference between good and bad later on. But it's important that you account for it in your designs. And as a general rule, like whenever you lay out one of these screens, always look at it in like what's a good circumstance, what's a day-to-day basis, and what's a really, really bad circumstance. Because if the bad circumstance doesn't look like, oh shit, then you're in trouble, you know. And you need to have visual punch in these things. Another thing, so the next sort of thing you'll see more of is, no, we have a nice effect here, is a single figure with context. So this is when you take a single figure, but you want to explain what that corresponds to within the last period of time. So this, what you see there is the old style, what we had before, the single figure, but we've put a spark line before it. I'm not sure if you're familiar with spark lines, but a spark line is typically, it's like a short, small graphic that answers a question of what is the context of this. So all's really good for is seeing like a straight line, as in no change, a spike, or a dive. So things are kind of good, bad, or indifferent, effectively. A spark line is a great way of letting you spot that. So even if your site had an outage for 3 days during a month, the spark line would undulate to show you that. And that's the point of it. The reason you use that over a big line graph is purely real estate. It's you know, you can use a spark line in the middle of a piece of text. You can use it beside a piece of text. It doesn't need full screen width because you don't need that precision. So when you do need that precision, that's when you're asking about an entire period of time, and you want to have a look at exactly how it's going on. So you say, show me all the key moments this month. So, or like, say if you're looking back on the data to see how you're getting on, or if you want to compare things, compare 2 periods, 2 months. Like, this is where, unfortunately, a line chart is very, very tough to beat. It's tough to beat for a lot of reasons that I'll explain in a short while. But one thing you have to know about line charts is that they only work well when the size of the chart is richly plotted with data points. So if you have 31 days and you have a wide chart, that makes sense. Always make sure your scale is correct. You'll see line charts where the scale is off, whereas in they'll start at 30 and show you between 30 and 90, and you can read those things badly and make massive, massive bad decisions about your business. One point here is, so if we only had 5 data points here, so say we had January, February, March, April, May, and that was the only figures we had, that's a bad line chart to show that. And the reasoning is because we're visualizing something that we don't know in this case. Because it looks like sales went slowly up between April and May there. But if we don't know that, we can't show that. Okay? So if, you know, in this case, if April sales were, say, 12 and 12 grand and, say, May's was 48, it looks like we slowly grew that, but maybe that's not the case. If you look at that under what we do know, these are just the 5 points, you'll realize, you know, things look a bit more erratic. It's a subtle change, but it's a different set of, it's a different result. You know, one way looks like we're growing, another way just looks like, you know, the sales pattern is erratic. And it's important to note that whenever you're going to pull out line charts for short data sets. So it's rare you'll do that in and of itself. It's rare you'll just look at a particular set. Usually you're looking for a pattern or something like that. But a more common case is when you're trying to analyze a period and you have a target that you're shooting for. Now, this target could be last month, or it could be our sales targets for the year. Or it could be like our acceptable usage policy, or it could be any of those things. So the obvious thing, and what everyone does here, is something like this. Okay? And this isn't a great idea. If this was our year sales versus the target, it looks like we're there or thereabouts okay. And the danger here is something that you'll see in a lot of infographics and visualizations. When we talk about the reality and the target, we're really interested in the difference, the delta between these two figures. But when you have a look at a chart like this, the delta is, you know, thinly masked between the two lines. You can't focus on it. You can't track it. You can't account for it. That, if this was your targets for the year, your boss might be inclined to say you're doing pretty well. However, if you just visualize it a slightly different way, this is the exact same data. This guy's getting fired. Same data set, but he's in trouble, right? You can see 4 times he's made it. One time he missed it by a little bit, and every other time he was a good bit short. And you can see I've switched to percentages off as well rather than actual just scale. But it's the same data, it's just a different story. And that's a sort of key point. If your question is proximity to a goal, then you want to know the miss, but you want to know the miss in context, not in terms of like euros or thousands of dollars or whatever. Just, you know, percentage is the right way to work it. So another thing you'll have to do regularly in any of these visualizations is break down a variable into constituent parts so that it can be analyzed in isolation. An example of this would be like, who are our customers, or what country are they in, or, you know, what browsers are people using these days? And this is where everyone, you know, without thinking, straight away throws out a pie chart. And pie charts are beautiful. They look great. They give you an opportunity to put so many colors on the screen. And, you know, the thing is, as a designer, I've sat there and, like, I've had bosses go, oh, I'd really like to see some colors, you know. But that's not what you're trying to do. If what you're trying to do is show how a particular number is broken down, pie chart isn't a great way to do it here. We can see here in this case, Ireland is coming first. It's about the only thing we are coming first in. But after that, it's kind of a mess. You don't really know. I mean, how's Canada doing in comparison with, say, Australia? It's not jumping off the page. They look roughly even. You don't really know. And then the next thing you see people do to avoid this problem is they go and put the data on the pie chart. And obviously, then you have to ask, what's the point in the pie chart if you have to spit out the data as well? You know, we're either going for one thing or the other. So if we were to take this as a sorted bar chart, it's now pretty clear who's who and what's what, right? Unfortunately, a sorted bar chart is by no means as colorful. You can add colors in there, but I would encourage you not to, because they don't mean anything. They're there for decoration. And, you know, you shouldn't try to be trying to decorate your data here. Your goal isn't to produce fanciness. Your goal is to communicate. A note on bar charts, you can do some clever things with them if you are in a position where you need to lie. You can add a third dimension. This is a subtle point, and whilst I'm absolutely confident it was deliberate, it's a very small win. But if you add a third dimension to a set of data, you have the opportunity to lie, basically. So what Steve's done here is he's tilted the greens pie, which is Apple, towards you, right? This means you see a lot more green pixels, right? And the purple pie is tilted away from you, so you're going to see less because of the perspective, okay? It's the same logic that goes behind the old MySpace shot, you know, where people click down like that. It's the exact same. You hide the bits you don't want people to see, right? If you take the exact same data set, Apple are clearly in third, but that's not what he wanted you to see. So, you know, you have the opportunity there to, if you need to abuse it, basically put the figure you want to promote at the front, put the figure you want to hide at the back, and tilt it. A couple other bad examples you'll see of ways to break down a group is an area plot. An area plot, which is where we basically throw out spheres or circles, and the idea being the area of the circle somehow relates to the size of the variable. So, again, these things can look colorful. I've deliberately not put color in here, but if you wanted the gradients, I can do that. You know, the point being, if I asked you, if these are all pizzas, and you could have pizza A, or you could have B, C, D, and E, which would you go for? Now, because I'm on stage, I'm asking this question, you know it's a trick, right? But if they were pizzas, you know, maybe I think most people would probably start, like, you know, they'd be tempted by the variety, at least, of B, C, D, E. The point being here that you don't know, right? A is actually bigger, obviously, than every other one put together. The reason you don't know is because we don't have an inbuilt mechanism for gauging this, okay? We can see a difference in size, but the difference in size there is what's illustrated in that last disk. And if I asked you how big is that, we don't have a way of actually discussing that. In that, even if I gave you a pizza, if some god-awful pizza that was just a disk with a hollow in the middle, and I said, how big is this pizza? You would not know. You'd sort of say, well, I reckon I could finish it in 10 minutes, but I'm not really sure, like, you know. And that's just purely because, as humans, we just don't have a need for that, okay? I'll come back to what we do have a need for. But one thing that is just you don't use on a day-to-day basis is gauging the area volume of a disk. So, another silly one you see, and like these are often run in magazines, is like the unit plot where you just basically count out the numbers and then you use lovely, pretty colors to try and highlight that point. And if someone asks you then, oh, well, like the green charts here, how are they doing? And you're like, oh, okay, well, it's 4, 8 across times 3 minus 1, okay, so that's that, and then blue is 9. What are you doing? Like, computers are here to solve this sort of stuff for you. Why, you know, and like, I've seen people sit there and like tap a pen on their monitor on each of them, go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You know, you have to question what are they really shooting for, but the point being that bar charts might not be sexy, but the ability to follow a line is something we all have. It's the same reason you can read. It's the same reason you can tell if like a tall guy and a short guy approach you and you have to fight one of them. You know, it's the same skill. We're good at gauging height. We are, and you know, it's something we have. And in general, when you're trying to communicate something, use stuff that they're good at gauging. So, another thing you'll have to do is communicate breakdown of an item over time. So this is the question of how has the composition of something changed over the last year? So this could be like compare like browser usage with January, and let's see how it moves all the way through to December. And the most common thing you see for some of this is a stacked bar chart, okay? Well, a stacked line graph or bar chart. So here you can see Ireland, UK, and America. And naively, it sort of say, well, it looks like America peaked in July. America's the yellow one here. And the problem is most people don't know how to read these charts, okay? They're not easy charts to read. If you want to see how any given one of these is going, it's not clear right there. If I was to show you the same data set again, here's another example. If you want to lie with dimensions, here's what you do. Tilt it. You get double the effect this time because you also get the side of the chart. But if nothing else, I hope this argument about lying will convince you to take that third dimension out of your graphs. Again, it's something we're not particularly good at. Here is the exact same data. Okay, now we're seeing that America has done pretty well over the year. We're seeing that UK has not changed at all. And we see that Ireland is the cause of most of the fluctuation. Now, that's kind of obvious, but it's not clear enough. You can't, for example, tell me that in this chart here, you can see that the green segment hasn't changed whatsoever. And that's just because it's a bad visualization. So another way to show this, and there are a few. This is one. If you wanted to see how is breakdown working, this here will show you pretty clearly. that for a start, you can see America's on the up. You can see that the UK hasn't changed. You can see that the blue spikes in the bar chart are accountable for all of the volatility. Because they're interactive, because there's a temptation when you start designing to think that this is all going to be stuck on paper, you can do things like unhover, fade out the bits that don't matter, or promote the pieces that do. That kind of gets you the best of both worlds. But someone's phone ringing. Okay. So the question, why are we not good at doing this? It's the exact same reason we're not mostly good at snooker or for you guys pool, right? It's actually the exact same skill. Can you gauge the thickness? In this case, this guy is trying to gauge, will the white ball pass that pink ball and hit the red ball at the correct angle? And to do that, he needs to see, does the width of this ball and the width of the path change as it moves through these different angles? That's the exact same skill you need to track green here. So, when we have the data, we have to know which visuals can communicate what. And a great example, the best ways to communicate things in terms of quantity are, firstly and foremost, always line length. It's, gauging relative size or length is always going to be how people will spot things. That's how two people get stand beside each other with like half an inch in height difference, and you just know who's taller. And there's no real logic behind that, but you somehow know it. Width is the second best. Width will help you at times. It's nowhere near as clear, because you can't answer confidently there how much thicker is the middle line than the bottom line. You could have a guess, but everyone can kind of tell me that like the middle line in the length chart is roughly twice everything else. Color intensity is an option. Now, it's an option when you're kind of running out of options, okay? It's good, but it doesn't, like, no one knows. You can tell that dark red is going to be heavy and light red, or the faintest red, is going to be weak enough. But you've no idea of really quantifying it. You can put them on a scale, and that's about all you can do. Size, we've kind of talked about. And quantity is one of those ones where you get the visual impact, but you don't get the clarity at all. And lastly, we have something like speed. So speed is useful in motion charts. So motion charts are kind of, they're slowly coming on board. The problem with them is the technology's there, but the human brain isn't for a lot of people. You can watch all these things jump around the place, and if you've ever seen Hans Rosling's TED Talk, you'll know what I'm talking about. There's a lot of data moving, but it's just not that clear what's going on. If you want to visualize category, and by the way, everything you're doing in an infographic comes down to these two things. You want to visualize category, or you want to visualize quantity, i.e. there are 6 people in Ireland, there are $24 in your bank account. It's always those sort of things, right? It's one or the other. That's where you have to play with reliably in quantity. If you step outside this, you're asking a lot of your users. And for category, what you have is line type. That's kind of, in Gestalt terms, it would loosely be called form. So as in, is it blurry, is it sharp, is it dotted, is it edged, does it have a texture, does it not have a texture? But you can basically, that's one thing you have to play with. You've got color, obviously. Now when I say color here, I don't mean color intensity, which is what I meant before, where you've got scales of red. I mean different hues altogether, so red, green, blue. You've got shapes. And you've got location on the screen, or location in your graphic. So you can tell, like, everyone knows that those 3 guys are being ignored by the other 9 guys. So that they can sort of see that there's a bit of bullying going on there, right? Or you have the map. A map is a pretty simple way. It's a simple technique you can use. It obviously only works when you're trying to communicate geography. So let's put all this together for a bit. Say if you'd just taken over a hotel and you're handling the accounts. So ordinarily, this might be Excel hell. But if you had to ask some pretty quick questions and get some pretty quick answers, let's say you're asked, are we making money? Well, whether we're making money or not is basically, what's the difference between money in and money out? And right now, what's jumping out at you is that in the summer months we do well, in the winter months we don't. Same as most hotels. Another question would be, what's the core of our business coming from? So this is a breakdown of across categories. Where is the money coming in from? So you break it down and use a bar chart to sort it, And then you'll see, right, most of our money's coming from rooms. And probably rooms, weddings, and bar accounts for the majority of our money. So if we're spending a lot of money keeping our restaurant going or our conferences going, maybe we could get rid of them. How do the rooms sell? So this is an interesting one. What we're showing there, each of those shows a max and a min point. And then that thick gray line is the median. So the median is the most frequently occurring value in the set, right? The median is quite interesting because the temptation here is always to use averages. I would estimate that everyone in this room has more than the average number of legs. Okay? Whereas everyone has the median, I'm guessing, right? That's the way average works, okay? And that's why it's not necessarily always a useful value, because you can have one outlier will totally skew your average and hide from you something that's actually quite important. So another thing you need to be careful to do is design for what I call queries. So this is when you need, you know, you need to permit the people using your visualizations to interact with it. So you need to let them change the dates, you need to let them change the times and break down stuff. It's important to have a query-driven dashboard specifically for analysts who are working at that level. Finally, a note on styling. So it's important to understand the context in which a dashboard is used, because they're called dashboards, they have this connotation of being a little bit cool. And that's not necessarily correct, right? This is the dashboard of a car, Mini Cooper. Okay? Its context there, it needs to let you know, are you running out of petrol? If you are running out of petrol, what can you do about it?
I just realized.
Ha-ha. No, the airplane mode doesn't work. Let it be known. When you look at a dashboard of a car, it would be a bit silly if there was a big green light on all the time saying, you have petrol, right? And that's why car dashboards don't do this. But what happens is other people do, which is a bit crazy, right? Likewise, you don't need, if you're a networks engineer, if you're feeling very lonely, but you don't need a big green monitor saying, things are okay, you know? What makes more sense there is a monitor that fades away into the background. It can just show black pixels and sit there doing nothing. But when that comes on, it should be like full red and shouting. But if the normal is quiet, then the normal is quiet. So, that's how cars work. They only let you know about problems. And maybe they have one light on to tell you, you have your lights on or the engine's working okay. This is the nuclear power station, in case you've ever wondered. This is the interface they have. Again, they have their own set of concerns. It's unlikely you're designing a dash for a nuclear power station, so you should not take design influence from that. This is a space shuttle. People using this have about 20 years of advanced astrophysics and stuff behind them. Probably not your users. Again, not a great source for design inspiration. Someone's using your dash in a place like this. And you need to realize that when you get carried away and start using petrol gauges and speed dials to communicate stuff. So, styling a visualization. Hands up here who would actually call themselves a graphic designer, just out of curiosity. That's a decent group. That's a good group. Okay, I'll tell you now, I am it. Right? I'm a user experience designer. I have some skill in the area, but what I've learned about infographics is that you could argue the merits of this, but you don't necessarily need to be a very, very good visual designer to make a clear infographic. And the danger is, if you try and you're not, you're going to make it far worse. So here's a sort of typical example of someone will hand this to me and say, well, here's where we started, but I can't really design, And I'd always sort of say, well, stop trying to design. You don't need visual punch here. This isn't going on the front page of Vogue. At that point, I turn over to Edward Tufte, who has a series of great books. The best one is probably called The Display of Quantitative Information. And there's three points Tufte makes that are very important. One of them is on removing chart junk. So chart junk is the stuff that doesn't change when the data changes, i.e., if you consider your screen a blank canvas and there was no data in your charts, what's on the screen? He calls that junk. Now, a certain amount of it is acceptable, axes, titles of graphs, but if there's an awful lot of extra effort there, like a lot of steel, brushed metal, chrome to give like fancy effects, that's the sort of stuff he considers to be junk, noise. If there's shadows or if there's gradients that aren't necessary, if there's variation in the fonts that you're using for no reason whatsoever, any of that sort of stuff, it's all kind of bad design anyway, but it's especially prominent on dashboards. Another point Tufte makes is about, it's about like, how can I best to phrase it? When you've eliminated the sort of the junk, what you're left with is, you know, the data. So he calls this ratio the ink versus data ratio, basically, which is basically of all the pixels that are firing on the screen, with the exception of the background, what's the ratio of stuff that's data to stuff that's not data? And you should try and keep that pretty strong on the data side of things, in that if there's stuff showing up, it should be because there's data there, not just because you wanted to put in a picture of a globe to try and like make the whole thing pop, you know? The other thing Tufte was a proponent of is what he calls the least significant difference. So when you're designing these things and you want something to stand out, unless it's like brown trouser territory, the whole site has gone down, he says use like the least significant difference that will make something pop, not the most. So if something needs to stand out and you have a table full of gray data and you want one number to stand out, red will probably do. You do not need font size 72 Times New Roman with a drop shadow against a red gradient background and alarm bells playing. It's not necessary. Like people, you know, you're trying to create a sedate atmosphere. You're not, you know, you don't want to have this noisy web app. So if we were to take this sort of straw man, if you like, although it's not really genuinely, this comes from a real example. What we can see is going on here is we've got gradients, borders, backgrounds, shadows, grid lines, and colors, right? And none of them mean anything. Okay. None of those things mean anything. So, very simply, let's get rid of them. Right? That's a good chunk of the unnecessary is gone. We still have a piece hanging around, which is the colors. So if we drop them too, we're now looking at a calmer set of data straight away, okay? Just simply by not doing stuff, right? This is what it looked like before you started designing it, if you like, right? Ryan Singer from 37 Signals had a great point for web design where he said, we have a strong tag in HTML, you know, you can drop into strong and that makes things big and bold, right? We don't have a weak tag. And what you get there is a kind of a linguistic relativity argument, but basically what it means is that the language we have kind of informs how we think. So if we start off with black, we can't get any darker than black, so we can only get bigger and bolder, right? Which means you end up, that's a slippery slope towards having everything louder than everything else. Okay, so black isn't a great starting point. And you know, if you try and shift that a little bit, you kind of get a quieter screen. If you sort of say, well, let's say the default text is maybe just a dark gray, that means we can go darker, which means we don't have to get bigger and bolder all the time. We can just do a subtle darkness. So if we go from here and we just say, let's tone it back a bit, right? Again, just by doing the simplest of shifts, we've gone from now like a noisy screen to a quiet screen. Now, we've probably gone too far. So if we add it back in a little bit of distinction, a couple of grid lines, and maybe use a color because we want that 4.32% to pop, that's an appropriate use of color. We now have a calmer interface. You can print that, you can stick it on a screen, you can stick it on a monitor, whatever, but what it isn't is this, okay? And that's just by pulling stuff out of the design. So we're approaching closing points. You guys are the best because you're going to get to the lunch table first. Visualizations have to say something, okay? So the worst ones are the ones that you just kind of look at and go, look, the business is doing stuff, okay? And they're what I kind of call like the Jessica Simpson of infographics. They can look good, but they don't make sense, right? Another point, is there anyone here in this startup scene or anyone involved in a startup? So, okay, there's a handful. We do and have done for a while a lot of work with startups, and the dashboard screen, like for their own business, is something that always comes up as like being pressing and relevant. And I'd argue that it's not really, because you need to have like a lot of data. Like you'll be a long time building your app before having a dashboard is your big problem. And I mean a dashboard for the business. I don't mean for like people who log into the app. But So for our own app, we've kind of evolved the dashboard over time. Oh yeah, so one thing I should say is keep away from vanity dashboards. You know these, like, you've got 3 followers on Twitter, $0 in the bank, and your wife's left you. You know, like, try and keep away from designing those, like, you know, artifacts of vanity, because, you know, any time I've ever been involved, and people have always said, the dash looks great, but I'm not happy with the data. And I was like, yeah, well, maybe we should have focused on that first, you know. So start with the basics. So as in, your first dash should be nothing more than selecting rows out of your database and totaling them. That's all you really need. Because, you know, you don't have a month's worth of data, you don't have 6 months worth of data, there's no room for analysis. And then add the insight as you need it. So as you grow and you realize what's interesting, you can start saying, well, how does this period compare with last period? We can start sorting things as we need them. Add a yearly view when you have a year's worth of data, whereas I often see people obsessing over this sort of stuff when it's just not a problem for them. And then when you've got that, you can then start looking at, like, you can then look at insights and, like, next steps, how we can tie in these sort of actions. And finally, then you can look at things like projections as you need them again. So you can project ahead, looking ahead, when you've got a solid business. You don't do that from the start unless you're really, you know, you're going for one of these Silicon Valley pitches of, like, you know, the online dog sharing market is worth $4.4 billion according to Forrester. You know, that, they're the times when you see the sort of projections. But the other things dashboards can do for a web application is they give you, like, an insight into the engagement. And by the engagement, I mean, like, if you're a photo sharing app, like, say you're something like Instagram or Flickr or whatever, if you were to plot out, say, number of photos against number of logins, you might see some interesting data. So you might see, for example, like, that in here we've evolved, high into the right are the people who are using our application a lot. Low into the left are what we can call dead customers almost. They don't log in, they have no photos. So when you've got them clustered like that, it kind of, you know, it lets you stop kidding yourself going around saying I've got 40,000 users if you know that 25,000 of them aren't doing anything. Now, again, if you're in Silicon Valley, kidding yourself is what is the name of the game, right? But another thing you can do is, this is interesting, if anyone is considering a startup along the lines of, and going along the lines of freemium, you can plot things. So this is like what's called a Markov chain. And this shows how customers have moved through the path. So you can see that people who sign up, 70% of them go for the free plan, and out of those who go for the free plan, 75% of them disappear. Whereas if you take the basics, you kind of get a much better outcome. If you're trying to work out how does free work out for me or does freemium work out for me, what you're looking at is what's the movement from free to money. And if it's very, very small, then you're probably kidding yourself again. And there's an argument for then getting rid of the free plan and saying, well, let's just work with real people who we can devote real time to. If you want to talk more about that, by all means, come see me after. Lastly, a note on usability, impact, and power. So Joel Spolsky is one of my favorite bloggers and speakers. He made a great point a long time ago. He said, usability is not everything. If usability engineers designed a nightclub, it'd be clean, quiet, brightly lit, lots of places to sit down, menus written in 18-point Arial, easy to find bathrooms, and nobody be there. They'd be all pouring drink over each other, coyote ugly. Okay? And he's right. Because usability can't be your only goal in this world. I mean, imagine, like, if you're a chef and your only goal was, I make edible food. You know? There's more at play here that you want to shoot for, okay? And it's okay to sort of to sacrifice a little bit of, you know, clarity for a bit more interest. For example, how long do animals live? This is an infographic, for example, right? And it kind of, you know, that's a nice way to show it, okay? It's not crystal clear. It's not a bar chart. But, like, if you're going for magazine spread or something like that, that's okay. You know, you don't always need to be crystal clear. So as I said, it's okay to sacrifice clarity for emotional impact, so long as you know what you're doing. Unfortunately, most visualizations sacrifice clarity for nothing, you know, and that's where you're going wrong. And lastly, we're not always designing for first-time users. So there are times when it makes sense to design a powerful infographic for somebody who's in the domain, knows the domain, and can use it. That's useless to everyone else, okay? Like, a doctor's medical chart, it should not be designed with me in mind so that when I go in there and I can see the chart, I can understand it. I want my doctor to understand it, first and foremost, right? It has to work for him. So this is a great example. This is a company called Visual Sports, and they plot out soccer players. And there are scouts who can look at this chart and tell you straight away, you're all there following lines and all this. But someone else can look at this and say, Xavi Hernandez is a fantastic midfielder who plays most of his balls to Iniesta. It's best off playing the two of them together. And he, to somebody, not one of you guys, but to somebody, all of this information jumps off the chart and he'll say, we want him, or drop him, or whatever. Because it's all clear, right? As in, they're used to reading this. What they want to see is a thick line of blue, and they want to see an awful lot of blue coming out of it, because that means he plays an awful lot of short one-touch passes across the midfield. And that has to be clear. Again, doesn't have to be clear for you, has to be clear for the recipient. Another example would be the same company, Visual Sport. They can compare two footballers, and they can do so using all sorts of nice ways. They can show where the player moves around the pitch. Again, for the likes of us, it looks like gobbledygook, stylish gobbledygook, but it doesn't matter. Like, to those people who need to understand it, it's crystal clear. And that's all I want to say. Please fill out your feedback forms, and thank you very much for your time. I'll be here for questions. Any questions? Yes. Sure. I'm not sure. I can repeat the question if you like.
Hello. Great. This was really helpful, so thank you. I was wondering, I think one of the most interesting things was focusing on like a single piece of data to really show. And one of the things we hear a lot from our users is that we want to see like 10 or 15 factors all in the same place, so like it's not really enough to be able to see one thing. We have to be able to see like six or seven elements. Yep. So how do you handle that request? Is that like a click through or like other interactivity?
So the question is, if we have a lot of individual pieces of information, is there a good way to get them all on the screen without bombarding the user with like 15 different numbers? So your options there are, first of all, grouping, which is obviously like the obvious solution, right? Which is you group them by domain or by type or by specifics. And so, for example, you might put all the sales figures together and give that a sales thing. Another option which I'd strongly consider, and it only works in certain domains, is there like a hybrid number that summarizes exactly what all this accounts for? So I'll give you an example. Like, there's a company we worked with a while ago where what they have was, like, they wanted to look at what the lag time of something was, and lag is made up of like seven or eight different things, but they've concocted a way of like coming up with one overall rating of like good, bad, indifferent that kind of accounts for all of those variations. So if that is possible, and there's a bit of maths at play there if you want to combine a lot of variables to come up with a summative score, if you like, but it is useful. Aside from that, grouping is one way to do it. Drill down is another. And the last way I'd give you is like sort of a, if it's okay to sort of shorthand the variables, so as in if the number can be good, bad, or indifferent, you can use a sort of traffic light style effect. So maybe in sales you'll see like four green lights and one red light, and if the person using it knows that red light, they can click on the light and be taken straight through to the problem. So that will kind of give you that high level analysis. So at a glance you can see there's no problems or there are problems, whereas, you know, if it's all green, you know you can step away. So hope that's okay. Hi.
What's some of the best ways that you handle outliers, especially with things like spark lines, where it just completely skews the scale on the graph?
So how do you handle outliers? So they are data, so they can't be ignored. And an awful lot of programs will just kind of chomp the outlier and sort of disregard it. The reality is an outlier is usually an indication of something, but there are like the statistical techniques to get rid of them, as in you can give confidence intervals instead of giving a precise value. So an example would be the hotel room example where I said the median is here, and then I sort of said you can then provide like the sort of 95th percentile either side. So you can sort of indicate that 95% of people lie within this particular range here. That's the simplest way to sort of, you know, to get rid of them. The only lasting point I'd make on spark lines, which is, you know, a lot of spark lines get spoiled because they say for showing month to month and you include the last month, every single spark line takes a dive because the last month is never complete in a set of data. As in, like, you know, right now we're not done with April, so April will look like the worst sales, you know, on record. So it's always important to make sure that whenever you are going to do a spark line, make sure you've got the right period and it's all complete. But that's okay. Hi.
So I'm not sure how relevant my question is to everybody in here, because I just don't know what everybody does. The question I wrote down is, based on your presentation and the need to understand, categorize, and communicate content to your user, how important do you think the user experience designer is in that process?
The user experience designer? Okay, so based on my presentation, how relevant do I see the role of the user experience designer in the process? So I have to, like, obviously declare that this will be a biased answer, because I am a user experience designer and I like my job, like, but I believe it's fundamental, to be honest, and because if you look at what a user experience designer does, they focus on the user, they work out the domain, they find out what are the goals of the end user of this, and then they design from that point outwards. And they have the ability to come up with sketches and prototypes and iterate, and they can and do an awful lot of simulations of what their design will look like under different contexts. I know visual designers can do that too, so I wouldn't necessarily draw a line between those, but fundamentally, yeah, I think any dashboard designed without somebody who's representing the user as a stakeholder is doomed to be like either an artifact of vanity or like just a useless piece of work. That's kind of my feeling, strong though it is. Anyone else? Okay, thank you very much, guys. Have a great lunch.